Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schooler.
Very, very privileged today to be joined by Sherina Rice, PhD, and we're here to talk about cognitive neuroscience and artificial intelligence and AI cybernetics. Don't worry, it's not going to be super technical. And whether you are into techie things or not, you will learn some very, very useful information. And if you stay until the end, you will learn if you can make a brain-computer interface at home. And Sherina is going to answer that question. So she is a neuroscientist, a cybernetician, and a storyteller in startups. She's a nerd at Nobody Studios. And she also contributes as an editor at the Neurotech Reports. She's a research scientist at a medical neurotechnology startup operating in stealth mode, and she earned a PhD in neuroscience at the University of Michigan. And she is continuing to defrost in the Silicon Valley. So it's lovely to see you again, Sherina. I really appreciate it. And I'm quite excited to dig into these really, really exciting topics, actually. And Elon Musk, he wants everyone to be connected with brain and AI. And I'm kind of interested in understanding the relationship between AI and neuroscience. So I think before we sort of dig into that, can you explain just a bit about what cognitive neuroscience is?
Cognitive neuroscience is about brain activity and neural activity and how that underpins processes of thought.
So and what is cybernetics? Context.
It is about circular causality. Cybernetics, it is sometimes talked about as artificial intelligence before artificial intelligence was known as artificial intelligence. And this is because it is about matters of cause and effect, often when it comes to machines and living things. So a car, for instance, that could be considered a cybernetics type of thing, partly because it has to at least somewhat understand human intentions in driving it, but also because it has to understand some things about effects so that it can keep us out of trouble. And so we have things like warnings for not wearing a seatbelt. We have things like warnings if we might run into someone or something. And these kinds of things, they help the system to work better.
Right, right. I mean, I've heard that there are a lot of driverless cars in San Francisco. Everywhere I've been, I haven't actually seen one, to be honest. I've seen electric cars, obviously, but the driverless ones, a friend of mine actually went out there probably about 3 months ago, and he said it was very difficult to spot a car with a driver.
I've seen a lot of driverless cars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a kind of crazy world we're living in now, right? I mean, we're kind of looking at the future of medical technology here and digital health and neuroscience, right? And those things interact together, don't they? And the future of healthcare technology is kind of exciting, isn't it? In terms of the way that we will be able to get, much more data from people's brains and analyze, how their thoughts are affecting their health. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, I think that it is. And a lot of information will come faster. It's great. There is this question of how much do we have confidence in it? For instance, how much do we extrapolate from it? How much do we say that this is correlative versus a causality type of thing? So for instance, my neural signatures of lying may be somewhat different from someone else's. But what are you going to make of that if that is the first time you've ever read from my brain? I think that there are questions of so many matters of processes, because it's easy to measure things that are given to the brain as stimuli. It's easy to measure things that are outputs. So for example, what kinds of behaviors a person does. But what happens in between, it's somewhat harder to measure. You can measure brain activity, but the same person may solve the same problem in two different ways depending on which day it is, or what they've been primed to do, or various things that have happened that day.
In terms of healthcare technology, I mean, I know there are lots and lots of sensors that are on everyone's devices right now. And in terms of the future of healthcare technology, what do you sort of see being the future looking like in that area?
I see the future as people will have more ways of collecting data from themselves, which is great if they want to monitor various things. But there comes this end of the day question of, are you actually happier and healthier than you were before all of these measures were taken? And so, all right, you can measure all kinds of things, such as your resting heart rate, and perhaps you can measure things like how strong or how frequent your alpha frequencies are, for instance, during certain tasks. I think that it will draw into question what really matters to you, what really matters to matters of your health, and that it would take a lot of reflection, because just collecting a lot of data in itself, it's not going to lead to a ton of sense making. But being able to interpret it in context with the rest of your life, it will possibly be able to make a difference and to see things before things go wrong.
Absolutely. They are doing lots and lots of great things within healthcare. I mean, certainly with all of the amount of data that is being able to be analyzed, right? It's kind of exciting, isn't it, in many ways? And so, you know, people are redefining the future of healthcare, right? But you think it should be sort of decided by people themselves, or what do you think about that?
I think ultimately people will choose to make their lifestyle decisions regardless of what a wearable says, because they're humans. So for instance, there are still people who have cardiac diseases, even if they have various things to monitor their heart. And it's not like just having the digital solutions solved that problem. But there have been major strides. For instance, I talked with an early member of the Fitbit team. And that was a great conversation, because he said that he used to work in cardiac surgeries and make robotics for them. But part of the reason why he was so happy to be on the Fitbit team was because he could solve that problem a few steps in advance, so that people wouldn't need to have the surgeries in the first place. And I think that this matter of looking at the signals and determining interventions and working with the person to come up with solutions, that is going to make for a good future. But also it does take effort. So for instance, what if we did have some sorts of digital solutions that detected Alzheimer's and other dementias early? Would people really use them, and also use them in a way that works and is consistent? I think that...
Yeah.
Things like crossword puzzles have been talked about for many years for that, and various gaming solutions. I think that it's kind of tricky to measure these things in their effectiveness longitudinally, but I am hopeful that that matters of learning continuously to allow people to maintain their sharpness.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are lots of studies, aren't there, around saunas and all sorts of solutions for dementia and stuff like that. So what do you see as the future of elderly healthcare? I mean, do you see robots being able to help people in care homes? Because I was doing some reading the other day about the Japanese have got lots of robots in the elderly healthcare homes, and actually they've been sitting in cupboards because it's too much effort for the staff to actually get them out and help people to use them for exercise, as an example, for exercise classes. You know.
Yeah, I think that they will be good, but the thing is that they need to be designed so that it's obvious to use them and that it's easy to use them. Because if a person does not use the machine in the first place, then even if everything about that machine is great after that, well, if they haven't taken that first step, it's harder. One thing that I think about digital solutions is that if they mimic the design of the analog version of them, then they could be a lot easier for people to use. I used to live in a Buddhist temple with people who were substantially older than me. And I would see them sometimes struggling with things that I would take for granted as a person who grew up with computers around. There is the sharing icon, for instance, for a lot of applications that has a box, and then there is an arrow pointing up out of the box, which if you poke on it, then that's a way to share things. But that took some explanation for them to realize that that was the case. But it's different if there is something that really does look like what it used to look like.
Right.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Absolutely. So, yeah, I think it's we're early days, really, aren't we? With helping the elderly. I mean, a lot of technologies are just not really designed for those people at the moment. And I'm looking forward, as I'm sure you are, to a more inclusive kind of world. You know, but like you say, you've got to use these technologies to improve them, right? And yeah, it's quite an exciting time right now, really, if you think about it. And so, what, you know, obviously there's going to be personalized medicine, there's going to be robotics that are used within elderly healthcare. On top of those kind of things, do you see any, you know, obviously analyzing data and coming up with kind of exercise plans and dietary plans? I mean, is that the sort of holistic view that you think is going to be available for the future of elderly healthcare? I mean, you know, what I sort of mean is, you know, if we're putting all these data sources together, we're analyzing all of this data, we're going to be able to continue to like lengthen people's lives, right? To such a degree that we will have to analyze the data if they want and encourage them to do all the right things if they want to stay healthy, right, for the rest of their lives. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I guess so. When it comes to analytics and healthcare, I think that part of the trickiness with humans is that it will take a while to see if things that we think will elongate lifespan will actually do so. So let's say that I came up with some sort of intervention that would expand your life for 10 years, I think, but it may take 10 years for me to determine whether that is the case or not. And so I am very skeptical of things that are in the longevity space for that reason. Now, I would generally trust people who have lived to be over 85 years old versus someone who is younger who says, I'm going to live to be X number of years, because you never know what's going to happen in that person's life. They may have some sort of decision someday that leads them to get hit by a bus and thus shorten their lifespan in a way that you could never predict with all kinds of things regarding health metrics. So there is this question too of what is the limiting reagent in a person's lifespan? Is it going to be something like cardiovascular disease or cancer? Is it going to be something in neurological disease? Those seem to be leading causes of death, at least in the United States. But a bunch of other things may come up out of a person's genetics that may not have been accounted for unless they've actually decided to get tested. And yet some people, they think that they live healthier, or they might actually live healthier if they are not worried about all of the numbers and all of the metrics and just live their lives in the ways that they do. Otherwise, they may worry, well, I'm not doing enough of X, Y, and Z, and well, I'm not enough. And that may lead them to an anxiety spiral in itself, which is a bit sad. And also it goes to show the multifactorialness, or the large amounts of things that go into an extremely complex equation. But still, I think that if we can stave off cardiovascular disease and cancer and neurological diseases, then people will generally live a lot longer.
Absolutely. There are lots of breakthroughs, aren't there? I mean, lots of people, I've heard of a few people having stem cell treatments for bad shoulders and things like this. So, I mean, I think, you know, from what I've been gathering, treatments is at some point going to go down so people can actually afford them. And I'm quite excited about the future of healthcare, but I'm also excited about neuroscience, AI, and the future of education as well. Did you want to have a chat about that briefly?
Sure.
Cool. So how does neuroscience, AI, and the future of education kind of fit together? Is that in terms of like learning journeys and analyzing people's behaviors and things like that, or am I sort of missing something?
Yeah, I think that education, it has generally been something that takes a long time to revolutionize. For instance, doing active learning in the metaverse, that is not a new concept at all. That has been tried decades ago with minimal success. But when it comes to really people being able to explore themselves and to make sense of their own things, I think that's where the power comes in, rather than you throw technology at a group of people and hope that they adapt to it or adopt it. So it's not just the tool itself, but how the tool is used, and also what the tool says about itself or the narrative around that tool for its usage. I've found myself that I've learned a lot about electronics by tinkering when I was a child, and we had various wires and electronics equipment in my house, partly because my parents are electrical engineers. And to me, that was fun. And it wasn't very computerized. And it was mostly this analog matter of, okay, how do you make the light bulb glow lighter? I mean, glow more.
Yeah.
And being able to try out different circuits to make that happen. That wasn't really a thing in the classroom, except maybe one day of science class when I was in elementary school. But at home, it was a thing. And so, yeah, one matter of education, too, is that ChatGPT is, it's like the homework machine that I always dreamed of having in high school, where there was so much stuff that we did in terms of being busy work without actually being all that useful for learning. Matters like looking for certain quotes in a book and summarizing all of them, or some matters of rote memory, but they weren't about original thought. And having this machine now being able to just summarize things and find certain quotes really fast, it means that hopefully children are not being asked to do these things that can easily be automated so much in preparation for the workforce in the future. That's my hope, at least, that it does push down the gas pedal in terms of educational reform, because the point of education is to help people to be prepared for a workforce so that they can make a living for themselves and to contribute to society.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's an interesting space. It's an interesting time right now. A lot of people are sort of complaining that ChatGPT shouldn't be used and, you know, all these sorts of things. But the fact is that they can complain about it, but it's being used whether they like it or not, right? And, you know, students are smarter than they actually think. And they can tell a student they're not allowed to use it from you know, the university or the college or the school, but they're going to go home and use it, aren't they, at the end of the day? So it's, I think, learning how to prompt these things, learning how to work with these things is sort of crucial. But how does neuroscience fit into the future of education? Is it down to sort of more personalized learning journeys? Is that kind of the angle with that?
Yeah, it depends on matters of regulation and things like that. So many things when it comes to developments in neurotechnology, they have to rely upon regulatory frameworks and reimbursement strategies. I would personally really like to have a brain-computer interface that told me what I was receptive to learning at the time. Kind of similarly to how there may be a playlist based on mood, or based on what kinds of emotional states I may want to go into. It would be great to have one that shows, okay, well, what kind of thing is your mind really in a state for right now? Are you currently in a state where if you try to do a writing task that you will be able to do this really well? Or would it now be a better time to watch a bunch of videos about some topic like Amazon Web Services and try to learn how all of that architecture works? So I think that receptivity is something that is not really part of any consumer product right now, but it would be interesting if it was.
Absolutely. That sounds very, very interesting. So over to you. So on one hand, you're doing research and development medical technology at this stealth startup. On the other hand, you're working more on the consumer side at Nobody Studio. Why did you sort of structure your life that way, and what does your kind of day look like?
I've structured my life this way largely because if I wanted to become excellent at startups, then what is the best way to do this? I think that it's to go very deep in a highly regulated and high barrier to entry type of industry. And healthcare, it is highly regulated, as is medical technology. And when it comes to consumer technology, though, it may be less so. Retail, it solves problems in ways that healthcare tends to not be as good at. So for instance, if I were to go over to a regular electronics store, then I could buy various things in computing, and I could expect them to generally work as I hope that they would. It's fairly easy to measure, okay, this computing structure was able to do this in this amount of time. But when it comes to biological things, it's a bit fuzzier. You can still get some matters, but also there is this matter of how did you measure it, and is that truly the measure that you were hoping for? The example that comes to my mind is telomeres. And it used to be said that telomeres and their length, they were...
I have no idea what that is. And I think probably most people don't know either. Well, not most people, a lot of people. So what's a telomere then?
Telomere is a molecule, and it contains DNA. And then as a cell divides, then the telomeres, they go over to the different cells that were divided into. But after a while, there is a thing called a Hayflick limit. And the Hayflick limit, it is about how many times this division can happen before it stops being able to divide. And so people have
Cool. Been
telomere length. If the telomere is long, then that means that there are many more division cycles for the cells left. And therefore, the person will probably live longer if they have longer telomeres. That has been the conventional wisdom for a long time. But then some researchers found that telomeres, if they are long and the person is fairly older, then that may also mean that they have a higher cancer risk. Because guess what else divides a lot? Cancer cells. And so there is this matter of interpretation that is at least as important as the collection of data itself.
So what does your day look like? One day you're messing around splitting up cells, and the next day you're doing consumer things. How does it look like a typical day? If you took one, what would it look like?
A typical day for me is to wake up and to have some sort of conversation about a startup in Nobody Studios or some sort of development within Nobody Studios about what we're going to do next in our adventure of creating 100 startups from scratch in 5 years, which has been a remarkable journey so far. We have all kinds of things from WebDelix, which is working to be the WebMD of psychedelics, to CatGPT, which generates cat memes or gifts. With captions.
I know people who would love that. Seriously. That's like, my friends would absolutely love the cat meme thing. Me? I'm not so sure. But I'm open to try these things. So what else?
And then I have my regular job, or my full-time job, which is working with machines and writing documentation, and sometimes working with research participants as well. And I guess that's the most that I can say about that, but I love it. And
right.
And then often in the evenings, since I'm in the Silicon Valley and there's a lot of cool things happening in the space, going and meeting people in the community and seeing what they're up to.
Of course. It sounds quite fun, actually. So let's say you just graduated from high school and you're about to start college today. What would you do to future-proof your career?
This is so tricky because if I'm at that point, then there is this question of what is going to happen within the next 4 years? 1 year ago, no one was talking about ChatGPT. Now a lot of people are using it. And a year ago, not very many people were talking about augmented reality. But now that Apple Vision is going to be released, then a lot of people are. And so in 4 years, that seems to be almost in an unimaginable amount of time. And yet it is totally imaginable. So then future-proofing. What are things that are the least likely to be automated? That's the first question that I would ask myself. Then I would create some sort of diagram of things that are unlikely to be automated. And in another column, I would write down things that I would like to explore and use the time of college as a matter of exploring things that are hard to automate or that really take a person's sanity check to see if the machines are doing things as we hope. And so I would probably still major in a biological science, and I would still minor in philosophy and psychology. And also, I would still go and interact with the community and connect with people. Because even though we do live in this very technology-driven world, I can't just have an automated system go out and create connections with other people for me. Rather, this matter of trust and authenticity, it's created by doing work honorably for a while and for knowing people. So I would probably still do quite a bit of volunteering and creating things like entrepreneurship events.
I think there's a lot to be said for the personal connection, but it needs to be really a lot of the time face to face or actually a conversation between one and another, because now, you know, they're getting so good at creating videos that are fake. It's actually quite a bizarre way that life is changing. When you can, if you think you can, you know, you can write something, well, you don't even have to write it. You can literally just digest your voice into an AI system. It will clone your voice, and then you can type the words, and then it will create, you can create a video of yourself talking. So I think that interaction back to back is good, but then that is actually being recreated, isn't it? At the moment, as we speak, they get it. They have the ability to have a chat model behind a video, right, of a person. So it's. But I think there's no real substitute for those people skills. I agree completely. But working out what is actually going to be in demand and what isn't in the next 5 years is an interesting. It's an interesting challenge, right? To come up with that. But so I've just got one last question. So what is the role of science in an age when lots of generative AI is emerging?
I think that generative AI, there is this question of, did this thing really tell the truth? Did it really solve this physics problem correctly? Does it really know how to synthesize things that are contradicting or seemingly contradicting in terms of evidence? One group, it says that 40 hertz brain stimulation is going to lead to plaque reduction in Alzheimer's disease, where another group finds that that is only the case when the information is actually relevant to the receiver. And so I think that when it comes to this matter of synthesis and this matter of sanity checking and this matter of what underpins all of this technology, that's where the science comes in. I think of it as a sort of sponge cake, and the sponge cake has layers to it. The top layer is there's technology, and underneath technology, there's science that underpins it. And underneath science, there is philosophy that underpins that. And the reason why this is a sponge cake is because sponge cakes have holes in them, or they have air bubbles. And that system of air bubbles, I would call that culture. And that infuses all three of them in terms of what questions we ask. And so when it comes to a lot of technologies, they are enhanced by some sort of understanding of the underlying mechanism. Why is that thing possible? Can it become enhanced if we did it a certain way? And technology itself, it can't really do that without actually testing hypotheses. But science, it is about testing hypotheses and sometimes observing what goes on without a hypothesis. For example, that there are stars up in the sky, and sometimes it's observational, exactly what is out there, rather than a matter of hypothesis. But nevertheless, there are things that can be proven, or rather, they can be found, there can be evidence found for them, or they can be falsified.
Yeah. It's certainly an interesting field. It's nice, you know, to analyze these things, isn't it, at the end of the day? You can't really have one without the other, can you? You have to have that analysis, don't you? So what about the question that all these people have been waiting for? So if people stay till the end, we would answer the question, can you make brain-computer interface at home? That's the question. What do you think? Is that possible?
I think that it is. You could also just buy a brain-computer interface.
Right. and are they expensive, or what are you sort of looking at?
Yeah, I would say that they are not very expensive, except for ones that are very research quality or medical grade. But you can buy a consumer EEG system for probably less than $1,000 at OpenBCI. And then Neurosity, they ship a crown for $2,100 these days. And various other companies, they also sell brain-computer interfaces that they can measure brain waves. Even a Muse headband, it can give you a 4-channel electroencephalogram, also known as an EEG, to track matters of meditation.
Wow. So is it possible then to make one at home, or do you think it's best to buy? I mean, obviously it's best to buy one, but do you think it's possible to make one at home?
Yeah, it is. The electrodes exist in the world.
Right.
The sensing things, they exist.
Right. That's super cool. Super cool.
And yeah, there are parts that can be 3D printed as well.
Right. Amazing. So if people got a 3D printer and they get some electrodes, they can make one of these things themselves, right?
Yeah. The amount of data and what that data will show you, it will depend on where you place the electrodes and how you place them. And
right.
It's still possible, though.
It's pretty cool, really. Pretty cool. So you wanted people to take away this very important thing. So if you are a competitive person but doubting your potential, you need to create an evil imaginary rival who has the gift of the gab without any technical or scientific knowledge, and then you need to compete with them. So that's what you are saying people should do. And I'm going to drop a link to your LinkedIn bio and your website in the show notes. And I want to thank you once again. It's been fantastic. And I always enjoy speaking with you. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And we really appreciate you.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. Thanks.